Now tell me right out loud, what are you supposed to do when you see the flash?
Duck and cover.
He did what we all must learn to do.
You
and you
and you
and you.
Wow. All right. Giant and once very loud artifact of the Cold War from the duck and cover era disappeared from its perch in a park in North Seattle last month. And our resident historian, Felix Bunnell, has spent the past few days trying to track it down.
Yeah,
this
good
is
morning.
Interesting. Good morning.
It's a twisted tale. There's some bad news, some good news, and maybe a chance for some better news in the near future. Kind of a roller coaster. Buckle in here. I got a Facebook message from a history fan on Monday, a guy named Doug Pratt, who lives in Elma, but he grew up in Kirkland, like I did. Somehow or other, he stumbled across a Reddit page that showed recent pictures of a giant Cold War era air raid siren and tower being taken down and hauled away. Sirens like this were all over populated areas back beginning in the early 1950s and were tested regularly as often as once a week. They were standing at the ready in case the Soviet Union sent those big, slow bombers over the North Pole so they would have time to warn that they were on their way with their nuclear weapons. Let's hear a little sample. Frank's going to help me here. I'm going to play a little bit. We'll pot it down right away. Don't be alarmed. This is a siren on tape of an actual functional Cold War siren. So if you hear that, you know you were in big trouble, right, 70 years ago. So Doug Pratt thought the photos he found were of a siren on Finney Ridge at the Finney Neighborhood Association. That's a very famous landmark. It's up on a tower. It's right there. Everyone knows what it is, right by Woodland Park Zoo. But then he figured out it was the same kind of siren at a place called North Acres Park at 130th and I-5, just north of Northgate, where it had stood for more than 70 years.
Then I got to thinking about, well, I wonder what happened to it, because like I believe I said in that message to you, them things are worth money. You know, and I'm wondering, did the city of Seattle, were they able to sell it? Or did they just haul it off to the scrapyard? I mean, what happened to it?
You know, I wondered why this was so important to him. And Doug said he likes engines, like the famous Chrysler V8 Hemi that actually powers the old siren. He also remembers hearing a similar siren at Houghton City Hall, which is now part of Kirkland. It used to blow regularly for volunteer firefighters and for air raid drills back in the 1950s. And basically, Doug Pratt remembers the darkest days of the Cold War.
I lived through it. I was there. I was one of them kids. If the siren goes off, get underneath your desk, kiss your goodbye. You know, it was back in them days, back in the 50s, and that was it.
So here's the bad news, okay? I reached out to Seattle Parks and Recreation. They wouldn't talk to me on the phone for some reason. I don't get why when public officials won't talk to radio people on the phone. I was like, come on, we want to... Anyway, that's enough inside talk.
It makes you like, what are you hiding?
Yeah, but through a series of emails, spokesperson Rachel Shulkin told me this, quote, "The tower was removed starting on March 18th because it contained lead paint and not safe to be in the park, especially since it was aging and may soon become a fall hazard," which you could say about all of us in this room here. Seattle Parks and Recreation reached out to several historic organizations to see if they wanted it, but they all declined. "The motor is being restored by Binford Metal in Kent. Let me know if you have any other questions," unquote. I had a lot of other questions, but I didn't get answers from Seattle Parks for another 24 hours. In the meantime, I called Binford Metal on Monday. Nobody knew what I was talking about.
No.
More about that in a moment. Okay, that's a little tease there, a little narrative tool there. Now, as for the, quote, several historic organizations who were asked if they wanted the siren, Seattle Parks later said it was just two groups, one of which was Mohai. I worked at Mohai for a long time. I know a lot of people there. I checked with Mohai. They said they got an email offering them the siren about 5 years ago. And in response to that email, they said, "How big is it? How much does it weigh? How will it be taken down?" Seattle Parks never responded. Anyway, I pushed back on that about Seattle Parks. They're gonna confirm today whether that's true or not. That's a big deal, though, if they didn't actually reach out to Mohai, or if they did reach out and Mohai had questions, they didn't answer them.
Yeah.
Okay. Then yesterday afternoon, I got a call back from Binford Metal, the salvage company in Kent. What they told me is that a guy named Rick Estes, the owner of a company called Ascendant Demolition, that's a company Seattle Parks hired to remove the siren and the tower from North Acres Park, gave the siren free of charge to Dave Binford of Binford Metal. So it sounds like the tower itself was scrapped. Haven't confirmed that. That seems to be the case, though. But the motor with the siren horn still attached, all there in one piece, is sitting at Binford Metal in Kent in an area they call their Field of Dreams, which is a bunch of rusted trucks and farm equipment and stuff that they hope to restore someday. Now, here's what I'm hoping is that Dave Binford will find it in his heart to donate the siren and the motor to Mohai or some other museum who actually gets a chance to respond to it. Because there's a Seattle high school student we met last year named Nathan Varese, who's an expert on these things. As we reported last year, Seattle City Light gave him a smaller World War II siren, which he then restored and donated to the Flying Heritage Museum at Payne Field. It's a great story. I talked to Nathan late last night. He was really bummed to hear the siren from North Acres Park had been sent to the scrapyard. He's had his eye on it for years. He says it's actually in better shape than the one at Finney Ridge, which has a bunch of parts missing. This thing's all intact. So here's the potentially good news. Nathan Varese is willing to lead the charge to restore the Cold War artifact and find a home for it at a museum if Dave Binford is willing to let that happen.
This siren itself is very rare and unique, so I feel there would be like options where we could get like fun, just thinking ahead a little bit, where we could get funding and stuff for it. I think we can find a museum to work with that and create a good partnership that should help restore it and get it all good.
Now, I asked the person at Binford Metal if Dave Binford would be amenable to some kind of arrangement, and they couldn't promise anything, but they didn't reject it out of hand. I also reached out to Seattle Parks and a few city council members to see if they'd be willing to help facilitate getting the siren headed toward a museum with Nathan Varese's help. Now, I don't know many 17-year-old World War II and Cold War era air raid siren experts, but we do have one right here in our own backyard with a track record of success.
You don't ever come across these sirens ever, not for sale, available. They're either rusting or like in a museum. So, you know, when you got a chance like this, you can't really let it slip through your hands.
So I hope to have updates later today on this. And who knows, keep our fingers crossed. Maybe this story will have a happy ending. But if it doesn't, it's kind of just a bummer that this thing that belonged to all of us ended up in a junkyard and not going to a museum that the public could enjoy it at. Because the one in Finney Ridge up on a tower, you can't see it. This one could be up close.
Yeah.
You could see it and maybe actually operate and
be
really loud.
Well, I love your approach to this because you have a kid involved. And the kid is saying, please hand this back over so we can,
And he did a beautiful job on the restoration of that World War II siren. It operates. It's gorgeous. He raised money for it with a GoFundMe. I think some of our listeners even contributed to the campaign, so who knows?
Okay. All right, Dave Binford. No pressure.
Yes, we're counting on you, Dave. It's all up to you, Mr. Binford Medal of Kent.
Felix,
in your field of dreams.
Thank you for all the work you put into this. This was a lot. That was a lot. We appreciate you.
Sure, you bet.
The impacts of climate change on our environment is becoming more and more evident. But one of the things we're learning more about is the effect that climate change has on our brains. Yesterday, I spoke with neuroscientist and climate journalist Clayton Page Aldern, author of The Weight of Nature. And one of the things he talks about in his book is that the effects of climate change on our brains should constitute a public health crisis. And I asked him to explain that.
For better or for worse, climate policy is predicated on cost-benefit analysis. And what I mean by that is governments aren't going to act on climate change unless it pencils, right? Unless climate action, the benefits thereof outweigh the costs. And I don't think we're accurately accounting for all the costs of climate change, right? There have been plenty of publications that have illustrated the extent to which a changing climate is going to require us to build seawalls, right? And it's perhaps, you know, going to damage infrastructure, and we should be pricing those effects accordingly. We also need to be paying very close attention to the manners in which a changing climate is hurting us, right? Physically hurting us.
And requiring more medical attention.
Yes. I mean, okay. Think about the expenses that are required to treat something like Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. Neurodegeneration is forecasted to explode over the next coming decades. And those projections, which come from professional organizations that study things like Alzheimer's and dementia, they're not taking the climate-induced effects into account either, right? And so I think that we are indeed, deeply unfortunately, facing what I would consider to be a public health crisis, but we're not attempting to put a price tag on it. Mm. And I think without that price tag, we're not going to see these effects integrated into our climate policy.
You're talking about more hospitals, more clinics, more doctors, more nurses. Is that what you're talking about? The infrastructure of the healthcare system?
And what it costs us as well. Mm. It's all of that. And it's also what it costs us. I mean, to go back to some less dramatic examples, we spoke about the manners in which critical thinking is influenced by a changing climate. If you're not showing up at work to the extent that you can otherwise, right, that's decreased productivity in the eyes of capitalism. But that's real, right? The fact that you're not as good at your job, that's going to mean things for your company. It's also going to mean things for you personally, right? And so when I think about the costs of climate change in terms of that health crisis. I'm talking about those healthcare costs, but also about the costs that are accrued directly to us, especially for those folks who might be uninsured, for example, right? One of the things we know about extreme heat is that it increases the number of emergency department visits.
Yes, it does.
Also for people with dementia at higher rates, right? So people who are already suffering from something like Parkinson's, they see an exacerbation of their symptoms and they wind up in the emergency room more frequently when it's hot out. So that's a cost. And if you don't have healthcare insurance, for example, that's going to be a cost that is accrued to you.
Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien. You know, climate change is a topic we talk about a lot in the news. And for some, they talk about it stressing them out, making them feel anxious. And there's evidence that while that might be true, what is happening at the brain level is climate change is changing us biologically. And so we invited neuroscientist and environmental journalist Clayton Page Aldern to join us to discuss his new book. It's called The Weight of Nature. Clayton, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much for having me, Colleen.
First, let's set the stage for a climate conversation. We know it can be controversial for some. So how do you define climate change and what's causing it?
Climate change is everything that is happening in the world today in some respect. And I don't mean to diminish the scale of the problem and kind of push it off and say, oh, well, because it's everything, we shouldn't be paying attention to it. What I mean by that is it's all around us, right? And in fact, I don't even really like to talk about this book in terms of climate change per se, because climate change is what causes us to notice these changes within us. It is environmental change that happens to be occurring because of human influence, right? Because of the use of fossil fuels. And yet, climate change is not that thing that is necessarily causing changes within our brains any more than other environmental changes are. But because the climate is changing, we are given cause to notice these changes within our brain. You know, really, I would love to have never used the phrase climate change in this book. This is a book about our relationship with the environment, right? The neurological correlates of environmental change. What is the biggest environmental change happening right now? Climate change. Mm-hmm. And so anthropogenic climate change gives us cause to notice what's happening inside ourselves. But really, this is a book about our relationship with the broader world writ large.
Our relationship with the environment. And you used it. What was that? Anthropogenic?
That's right. Human caused. So I do take the position, as most scientists do, that the climate is changing because of human influence, right? And that just turns the lens inward a little bit in this case, because we've got this notion of people forcing changes in the climate and then the climate turning around and forcing changes within us.
Very interesting. I'm curious, too, how you came to the intersection of neuroscience and environmental journalism.
Yeah, I am also curious about how that happens. I was working in a lab as a neuroscientist about a decade ago and realized I didn't want to not have windows in my life. And so I left the lab for journalism because it seemed like a place that I could explore the world in a manner that did cater to windows, for example, and talking to people. And in journalism, I was encouraged by an editor. I worked at an environmental magazine to look back at this background I had in neuroscience and just ask a teeny little tidbit of a question. Is there anything there? Is there any relationship between a changing climate or, say, the environment writ large and brain health? You're a neuroscientist. Answer that question for me. And honestly, I was kind of like, no, probably not. I mean, neuroscience is so easily sensationalized. How many articles have you seen with headlines, "This is your brain on X"?
Right.
And the last thing I wanted to do was alienate myself from former neuroscientists, right? Former neuroscience colleagues, excuse me, and say, "This is your brain on climate change." And yet when I started to pull at the threads, my editor was right. there was a lot there, right?
It makes sense. I mean, just on a small scale and not having any background in this, people flock to Arizona when they need that vitamin D and that energy boost and the stress relief that can come from nice weather. So our brains do change depending on where we live, where we habitate.
Oh, completely. And you're familiar with it in many other manners, right? You're probably a little more ornery in the heat, right? More aggressive, yes. You know?
Well, we see it in the news too, especially where temperatures fluctuate to extremes like over in Spokane, the first hot day of the year, we know there's going to be violence.
Yes. And so this book answers the question of why, right? People are, in fact, more aggressive, more prone to violence in the heat. People are less good at problem solving in the heat, right? Students lose points on exams on hot days relative to temperate days. This book is about the brain science of why those effects occur.
Let's talk about regionally. We are used to smoke season. This is an effect of climate change, creating more drought conditions, more wildfires. We are flanked. We've got Canada. We've got California. We have eastern Washington, smoke blowing in from all directions. Is there an effect of smoke on the brain?
Unfortunately, yes.
Okay. Let's talk about that, since that's a regional issue here.
Yeah, I hate to be the bearer of bad news here, but one of the things we know about smoke is, by definition, it's an extreme air pollutant, right?
Yeah.
And the effects of air pollution on the brain are very well documented, right? So PM2.5, particulate matter, this is the kind of stuff that can enter your brain through the nasal nerve, right? And what does it do there? It basically causes low-laying inflammation. It's this kind of low-level chronic inflammation that, with wildfire exposure, diesel exhaust exposure, right, living in a city, all the stuff that we're experiencing all the time, that kind of inflammation leads ultimately to neurodegeneration,
wow.
Right? And what do I mean by neurodegeneration? I mean things like dementias, like Alzheimer's and Parkinson's. So some of the really scary research out there on wildfire smoke basically suggests that there's this relationship between the pollutants in the smoke and a risk of neurodegeneration later in life.
Mm.
So what is the climate connection there? Again, because of climate change, we're seeing an increased frequency of these fires. And so by extent, an increased frequency of air pollutants entering our brains.
During a wildfire season, since you here live locally in the Pacific Northwest region, are you somebody who would wear an N95 mask?
Oh, certainly, especially on those days when, you know, you've got the AQI over whatever the threshold is, 150 maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a couple of years ago, I was in town for a meeting with some folks who had flown in from all over the place, and they were shocked that the air quality was what it was. It was a late October aberrant wildfire,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they were asking me, is it always like this? I said, well, unfortunately, some of the time in the summer and late summer it is. And they're like, how do you walk around outside when this is happening? How do you go on runs? How do you exercise? And I said, well, first of all, you don't, right? You don't go on a run when the AQI is like 250.
Mm-hmm.
And when I am walking from place to place, I have asthma, right?
Oh, and you also have asthma.
So yeah. I need to wear an N95 when air quality is that poor, or I'm not going to have a very good time. And
mm-hmm.
And so, you know, what do? I protect myself. I would argue other folks ought to be protecting themselves as well. Air pollution is...
All right. Thank you so much, Colleen. It's 7:48 now, joining us from the G and Ursula show, which you can hear from 9 to noon right here on Chi Radio. G Scott. G, remember this guy? Let's play this for a minute.
Bro, it sounds like a shotgun.
Ooh, I get upset just listening to it. Okay, he's a social media influencer who brags about his loud Dodge Charger Hellcat and uses it to wake people up in his Seattle neighborhood.
There's videos on his Instagram feed of him on his balcony and remote starting that charger, and it's like a bomb goes off, and it's the middle of the night, and he's laughing because he's like, my neighbors hate me.
Right.
Oh my God, and this is something he's bragging about. Well, the new thing is that a judge has barred him from driving his Hellcat.
Yeah.
So, is this going to stop him?
If I want to just talk to the judge.
Okay, let's hear it.
And if he were listening right now, I would say to him, what is your goal? what is your reason for taking away the Dodge Hellcat? Is it because you are concerned with this person being on the roads and because speed being a factor, considering he was going 107 miles per hour on the open roads downtown
in Belltown
at 3 a.m.? Were you concerned? Are you concerned about that? If the answer is yes, then his bail conditions should have been no driving at all. Don't take any car, because if you speed in one car, you'll speed in another. Right. So that just
that part,
it doesn't make any sense. So I would do that. Secondly, are you worried about the loudness of the car? OK, that's fair. But I don't think most people, I mean, being loud. Yeah, that's a nuisance, is a problem. We all have that one person in our neighborhood that has a loud car. Yeah. I used to have a loud truck, Colleen.
Oh, you had a diesel.
So tell me, I'd like to know the psyche of why was that important for you to have a loud car?
I don't want to talk about that. Probably not.
Give us some insight. Right. Oh, wait. Did it catch attention?
Well, you mean his princess truck?
I don't know what that means.
Okay. I'm trying to. All right.
Take your time.
Let me answer that honestly. And for those listening that maybe you have a little something put on your truck, you kind of feel good when you get in there and you just go to start it up and then go room. And when you were a kid, my fascination with cars, when I was younger, some of the first words I said when I used to play with cars was room, 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 right? So anytime then when I was younger and I would be in a truck and I'd be in a car and you see a truck going by and you ask them to honk the horn and there's been, always been, okay, I'm speaking for myself. There's always been a fascination for cars. So the noises that come from it, they trigger that too.
How do you get past annoying neighbor? That's the thing. Like, if I'm like harping on my, like, get it, da, 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 and the windows are open, I'm like, ooh, that was probably too loud. Yeah. My neighbor's probably, how do you get past this feeling of annoying your neighbor, waking them up?
Because I didn't care back in the day. Okay. I didn't really have a real job to go to.
Maybe Hellcat's problem here?
Yeah, the things that you start caring about once you got a real job, right, things change. But I ain't going to lie to you, Colleen. When I was his age, I kind of understand this young man. As a matter of fact, so much so, I looked at his social media.
Of course.
And his social media and what he is talking about on his Instagram is actually pretty good, except I don't like the speeding. I don't like that speeding stuff. That's dangerous. This young man should not be driving any cars, period. However, what he's talking about on his Instagram, it's kind of funny. He's sitting around. He's eating cereal. He's watching anime. I mean, Sully, you can relate, right? Kids love anime, right? That's going on. He's having Pop-Tarts in the toaster. He's a young kid. That part of it was cool. It was funny. I could sit around and see watching the story.
And he's lost making money off of it.
Yes, because he's really entertaining. Yeah. So I would grab him and say, hey, young man, you have a gift. You have a real gift. Why are you messing this up by speeding 107 miles per hour down a Belltown road at 3 a.m.?
Because something happened, your life is kind of over, and maybe someone else's, yeah. But
last thing, why are you trying to be a nuisance and annoy the neighbors with your loud stuff? Like, if you want to think big, think big.
Mm-hmm. So if you're the judge, what's your ruling? What are you going to tell him?
No cars. That's his condition. He cannot drive any cars. Mm-hmm. That would be my condition. Because I care. Because here's someone, if he can speed in a Dodge Hellcat, he can speed in anything. And some people tend to want to do that. Like, they don't decide. I'm like, oh, you know what? This is my other car. I don't like to speed in this car. Speeders are speeders, Colleen.
Yeah. Well, and you might be on the right track with this, because even after he got the reckless driving charge and was released, he continued to rack up citations. So not even the reckless driving charge is stopping him. And so I'll be curious next time we hear that Hellcat fire up.
Do y'all ever speed?
Yeah. I think I was a race car driver in my former life.
There you go.
I tell you what, as my eyesight kind of fell off a cliff, I'm a little bit slower these days.
Oh, like, sure. Yeah. Ever since if I have kids in the game, absolutely. But yeah. I've been known to put my foot on the pedal. And now we we turn to a different kind of discussion, the impacts of climate change on our environment. It's becoming more and more evident, but one of the things we're learning more about is the effect that climate change has on our brains. Yesterday, I spoke with neuroscientist and climate journalist Clayton Page Aldern, author of The Weight of Nature. And one of the things he referenced in his book is the danger of, you've heard these in the news headlines, toxic algae blooms, which we have experienced locally on hot days. So Clayton explained why those affect our brain.
When we talk about toxins that are released by algae, a lot of the time we're not even talking about algae per se. We're talking about what's known as blue-green algae. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not an algae at all. It's a bacterium. So cyanobacteria, blue-green algae, are these organisms that are effectively as old as time. They look like algae. They gather in blooms. And unfortunately, they appear to release a neurotoxin. And unfortunately, this neurotoxin appears to be airborne, right? And this is the kind of toxin that scientists have begun to understand as one of the most causal predictors, right? The primary risk factors for a neurodegenerative disease like ALS, right? This is Lou Gehrig's disease.
Yeah.
And in all these cases, right, harmful algal blooms influencing something like ALS, we're not saying that if you take one sniff of a cyanobacteria bloom, you're going to catch ALS. That's not how it works. What is true, though, is that if you are exposed chronically to these types of neurotoxins, you are likely increasing your risk later in life for experiencing some condition like that.
And when you talk about constant exposure, living near a lake that's prone to these blooms, or somebody has a job that puts
both.
Lots of exposure.
Yes, okay. Both would qualify. So there's
it's like living by a freeway.
Indeed.
Same exposure to pollution. Okay, so in close proximity to these blooms.
Yes, and we know this because scientists have studied spatially the distribution of ALS cases around lakes that are prone to these blooms and see an increased incidence of ALS downwind from the blooms in question.
Incredible.
And so unfortunately, there does appear to be a relationship between decreased water quality and increased risk of neurodegeneration. Again, it's not a fixed one-to-one, hey, if you live next to a blooming lake, you're necessarily going to come down with Alzheimer's or something. But scientists have indeed begun to suspect that these cyanobacterial blooms are a risk factor for those diseases.
That is Clayton Page Aldern, former neuroscientist and author of the book, The Weight of Nature. You can find our full conversation. We talked for about a half hour about all these topics on the Ross Files page at MyNorthwest.com.
What was your biggest takeaway? I mean, we talked about so much. We heard so much during the course of the show in that interview. What was a big takeaway for you?
I think for me, and what was really relaxing about talking to him about climate change, is that he's not trying to, you know, he's not the scientist in the movie running around trying to tell people we're all going to die and nobody believes him. He's just saying, listen, I was a neuroscientist. I study these things. I've been working on this book for 7 years. Here's the data. Do with it what you'd like. He has asthma. He doesn't like the fact that we have a smoke season, that it can, you know, those particulates
do get inside our brain. How damaging that is.
And so he wears a mask during smoke season. It's as simple as that. It's going, you know, and I've been going back and forth on the text line with a few of our listeners this morning that admitted they didn't listen to the whole interview because when people hear the word climate change, they're like, don't want to hear it. You can't ignore it, though. It's happening. Whether you want to say it's man-made or you want to say it's just the normal cycle of the earth, it's happening. Smoke is choking us every summer. Toxic algae blooms are happening. Hurricanes are more intense. So let's react to it. Let's keep ourselves healthy in the meantime, because as he said, people should be safer under governments. Unfortunately, the federal government is not doing anything to mitigate the health impacts of this. So we have to advocate for ourselves by wearing a mask and by making smart decisions about where we live. This is why Redfin and other real estate companies online have added a climate tab. And we've had that conversation
too. I did not know that.
Yes.
Okay.
People are interested in going, am I flood prone? Am I fire prone? We need to advocate for ourselves and demand that our government do more for us, because we can't reverse what's happening.
And what's unfortunate is it's people who maybe don't have as many resources
exactly.
or money that won't have as much choice in terms of where they live.
They're going to be filtered into the cheaper homes, which are going to be near these at-risk places.
Yeah. Okay. What was the name of the book again?
It was called The Weight of Nature. It just was released yesterday, and our full conversation again on the Ross Files page at MyNorthwest.com. Okay.
All right, thanks, Colleen. We are in the final minutes here on Seattle's Morning News, and that means it is Mickey Gomez time. Hi there,
good
Mickey.
Morning.
It's
Hi.
Good to see you.
Oh, now, I'm happy to be here.
Well, look, we received some info about a recent survey from Intelligent.com mm-hmm. with the headline. Here's the headline, folks. Half of business leaders say ChatGPT experience is more valuable than a college degree.
Yeah.
Now, that's some headline. So can you shed some light? What's the context of
yeah,
this?
Yeah. So for people who don't know what ChatGPT is, it is an artificial intelligence. It's an AI tool. It can help you answer questions. It can assist you with writing. It can assist you with composing emails, essays, and it can actually help you code. Now, we are not allowed to use ChatGPT here at Cairo News Radio or in the building, but a lot of people are using it at work. I used it this morning, actually, to help me write an email that sounded snarky.
Oh.
And I needed it to kind of soften the Ooh. Edges because when I went back and read it right before I hit send, I went, oh, no, that just sounds mean and punchy.
So what okay, do you code so into ChatGPT? Do you say take the snark out of my email?
Yeah, it gives you different opinions. Make it more heartfelt. Huh. Was
okay,
the one
I
chose.
Know
yeah.
who you were being snarky to. Like, can we, like, give me that?
That would explain the email this
yeah,
morning.
No, it wasn't to you.
Getting
no.
sidetracked. Okay,
no,
good.
No. I just, you know, I have, you know, we
can
all
transition you. We can right. yeah, go ahead.
No,
back to the story.
I have a side hustle, and somebody wrote back and just said, I don't have time. I don't have time. I don't have time. And so then ChatGPT actually helped me write something that was very nice and okay, good. Take care of yourself. Be nice and not be snarky. But anyway. Yeah, this survey was quite interesting. If you are in college right now and you're about to head into the workforce, they're saying these 800 business leaders are saying you need to have ChatGPT experience. And some believe that it is more valuable, like you said, than a college degree. 80% believe that ChatGPT experience is a strong skill for entry level positions. Some companies now, 6 in 10, I believe, is the number, are going to be training on ChatGPT. Lower level positions need to have this type of experience before they even apply for the job. So if you're putting together a cover letter, or if you're, you know, trying to rewrite your resume because you're headed back into the workforce, or you're going into the workforce for the workforce for the first time, you need to know this.
Hmm. Does it say which industries are using ChatGPT?
All.
But it didn't say
all,
the top?
No, it did not give the top.
Like
it okay. just said all industries. So I would think, though, that IT might be a good one if you want to go into coding. Mm-hmm. Perhaps if you work in advertising and marketing. I know that when I'm on Instagram, I get targeted for ads that say, you know, ChatGPT can make your business grow with more money. So, like, it is everywhere.
I worry, though, about, you know how we have forgotten how to spell mm-hmm. because we can use spell check, or it just right. automatically spells a yeah. word for you and you're like, great, mm-hmm. I needed to know, or you can Google it. I wonder what skills of our human brain are going to start to erode because the work is, and I'm not saying it's a bad thing, we're like mm-hmm. ChatGPT can be helpful for anyone, and so is spell check, but we lose that innate ability to do these
yeah.
human things when mm-hmm. we rely on technology.
The fact that I don't know how to get most places anymore, I just yeah. follow my GPS.
Yeah. yeah, no, or writing, handwriting. Yes. My children saw me write a note to the teacher the other day, and my son went, "What are you writing?" And I said, "I'm writing your teacher." "No, what does that say?" And yeah. I went, "Child, what are you learning in school?" And he goes, "Well, we didn't learn cursive." And so I'm like, and as I'm writing, I noticed, so it brought attention to my handwriting mm-hmm. because I type all day, yeah. I text all day. My handwriting has suffered greatly.
Mm-hmm. So are there courses? Like critical thinking.
Yeah. Are there courses out here for this stuff?
Yes, there are courses that you can take. You can take them at the community schools. You can, you know, Grammarly has a ChatGPT box. So if you use Grammarly as a college student, be careful, though, because it could be counted as plagiarism. And you could get into a lot of trouble for that. But yeah, they've got, you know, there's YouTube videos and ChatGPT. You shouldn't be paying for it because it is a free service.
All right, Mickey, this is a fascinating conversation to be continued.
Yeah, 8 in 10 say ChatGPT experience will be even more important in 2025. So next year. So like you really got to learn this now.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.